Each student carried whatever weapon he'd brought to Ginaz, and Duncan had the old Duke's sword. But he would learn to rely above all on his own abilities and reactions, not a talisman that reminded him of home. The young man felt comfortable now, and strong, and ready. He was eager to begin his training at long last. Inside the crater compound, the junior training master identified himself as Jay Wu. He was a muscular man with a rounded nose and a weak chin that gave him the appearance of an iguana. His long dark hair was kinked into snake-like dreadlocks. "The pledge," he said. "In unison, please." "To the memory of the swordmasters," Duncan and the other students intoned, "in heart, soul, and mind, we do pledge ourselves without condition in the name of Jewel Noret. Honor is the core of our being." A moment of silence ensued as they contemplated the great man who had established the principles upon which Ginaz was founded, whose sacred remains could still be viewed in the tall administration building on the main school island. As they stood at attention, the new instructor strolled up and down each row, inspecting the candidates. Jay Wu thrust his head forward, paused in front of Duncan. "Produce your weapon." He spoke Ginazi, with the words translated into Gaelic by a thin purple collar that circled his neck. Duncan did as he was told, handing over the old Duke's sword hilt first. Jay Wu's eyebrows arched beneath massed dreadlocks that hung like a thundercloud on his head. "Fine blade. Marvelous metallurgy. Pure Dama steel." He flexed the blade expertly, bent it back, then released it to snap into position with a thrum like a struck tuning fork. "Each newly forged Dama steel blade is said to be quenched in the body of a slave." Jay Wu paused. His dreadlocks looked like serpents ready to strike. "Are you thick-headed enough to believe crap like that, Idaho?" "That depends on whether or not it's true, sir." The Dur training master finally gave a thin smile, but did not answer Duncan. "I understand this is the blade of Duke Paulus Atreides." He narrowed his eyes and spoke in a warmer voice. "See that you are worthy of it." He slipped it back into Duncan's scabbard. "You will learn to fight with other weapons until you are ready for this one. Go to the armory and pick up a heavy broadsword, then don a full set of body armor. Antique medieval plate." Now Jay Wu's smile seemed more sinister on his iguana-like face. "You'll need it for this afternoon's lesson. I intend to make an example of you." On the pumice and gravel field in the crater, with forbidding crags all around him, Duncan Idaho clanked forward in full plate armor. The hauberk blocked his peripheral vision, forcing him to stare straight ahead through the slit. The metal pressed down on him, falling as if it weighed hundreds of pounds. Over his chainmail shirt he wore shoulder plates, gorget, breastplate, greaves, cuirass, and tasset. He carried an enormous two-handed broadsword. "Stand over there." Jay Wu pointed to a packed gravel area. "Consider how you intend to fight in that suit. It is not an easy task." Before long, the island sun turned his outfit into a claustrophobic oven. Already sweating, Duncan struggled to stride across the uneven ground. He could barely bend his arms and legs. None of the other students wore similar armor, but Duncan did not feel fortunate. "I'd rather be wearing a personal shield," he said, his voice muffled in the echoing helmet. "Raise your weapon," the junior training master ordered. Like a shackled prisoner, Duncan clumsily lifted the broadsword. With a conscious effort, he bent his stiff gauntlets into place around the hilt. "Remember, Duncan Idaho, you have the best armor," supposedly the greatest advantage. Now, defend yourself. He heard a shout from beyond his constricted range of vision, and suddenly he was surrounded by other students. They pummeled him with conventional swords, clanging against the steel plate. It sounded like a brutal hailstorm on a thin metal roof. Duncan swiveled and struck out with his blade, but he moved too slowly. A pummel bashed his helmet, making his ears buzz. Although he swung again, he could barely see his opponents through the slit in his helmet, and they easily sidestepped the blow. Another blade rang against his shoulder plate. He fell to his knees, struggled to stand. "Well, fight back, Idaho," Jay Wu said, raising his eyebrows in impatience. "Don't just stand there." Duncan was reluctant to harm the other students with his huge broadsword, but none of his flat-bladed blows even touched a target. The students returned to pound him again. Sweat poured down his skin, and black spots danced in front of his eyes. The air inside his helmet grew stifling. "I can fight better than this." Duncan responded with more energy, and the students dodged his thrusts and swings, but the heavy plate armor denied him free movement. In his ears, the roar of his breathing, the pounding of his heart was deafening. The attack went on and on until he finally collapsed on the uneven gravel. The training master came forward and tore off the heavy helmet so that Duncan blinked in a blaze of sunlight. He gasped, shaking salty sweat out of his eyes. The heavy suit pinned him to the ground like a giant's foot. Jay Wu stood over him. "You had the best armor of all of us, Duncan Idaho. You also had the largest sword." The training master looked down at his helpless form and waited for him to consider. "And yet you failed utterly. Would you care to explain why?" Duncan remained silent. He didn't make any excuses for the abuse and embarrassment he had suffered during the exercise. It was clear there were hardships in life that a man had to face and overcome. He would accept adversity and use it to grow stronger. Life was not always fair. Jay Wu turned to the other students. "Tell me the lesson here." A short, dark-skinned trainee from the artificial world of Al-Danab barked out immediately. "Perfect defenses are not always an advantage. Complete protection can become a hindrance, for it limits you in other ways."
"Good."
Jay Wu ran a finger along a scar on his chin.
"Else?"
"Freedom of movement is a better defense than cumbersome armor," said He Yi Resser. "The hawk is safer from attack than the turtle." Duncan forced himself to sit up and slid the heavy broadsword aside in disgust. His voice was hoarse. "And the largest weapon is not always the deadliest." The training master looked down at him, dreadlocks drooping, and gave him a genuine smile.
"Excellent, Idaho. You may yet learn something here."
Learn to recognize the future the way a steersman identifies guiding stars and corrects the course of his vessel. Learn from the past. Never use it as an anchor. Sigan Vicey, First Head Instructor, Guild Navigator School. Deep beneath the city grottos on Ix, the hot subterranean tunnels were illuminated red and orange. Generations ago, Ixian architects had drilled field-lined pits into the molten mantle of the planet, bottomless shafts that served as hungry mouths for industrial waste. The thick air smelled of acrid chemicals and sulfur. Suboid workers sweated through 12-hour shifts beside automated conveyors that dumped debris over the lip into the brimstone fires. Robed Tleilaxu guards stood perspiring, bored and inattentive. Dull-faced laborers tended the conveyors, removing items of value, gleaning bits of precious metal, wires, and components from wreckage torn out of scrapped factories. On the job, Kater Pilru stole what he could. Unnoticed on the line, the young man was able to snag several valuable crystals, tiny power sources, even a microsensor grid. After the Sardaukar raid on the Freedom Fighters 2 months earlier, he no longer had a network to supply him with the technological items he needed. He was all alone in his battle now, but he refused to concede defeat. For 2 months he'd lived in paranoia. Though he still had a few peripheral contacts in the port of entry grottos and the resource processing docks, all the rebels Kater knew, all the black marketeers he'd dealt with, had been slaughtered. He kept a desperately low profile, avoiding his previous haunts, afraid that one of the captured and interrogated rebels had provided some clue to his identity. Out of contact with even Miral Alekhem, he went deeper underground, literally, than he had ever gone before, working on a labor gang in the refuse disposal shafts. Beside him, one of the disposal workers fidgeted too much, glanced around too often. The man sensed intelligence in Kater, though the dark-haired man studiously avoided him. He made no eye contact, did not initiate conversation, though his work partner clearly wanted to make a connection. Kater suspected the man was another refugee pretending to be much less than he actually was. But Kater could afford to trust no one. He maintained his dull demeanor, pondering a shift in jobs. A curious work partner could be dangerous, perhaps even a face dancer mimic. Kater might need to flee before anyone closed in on him. The Tleilaxu had systematically wiped out the Ixian middle class, as well as the nobles, and would not rest until they had ground even the dust under their boot heels. Accompanied by a master, robed guards approached them one afternoon in the middle of a shift. With hair hanging limp in front of his fatigued eyes, Kater was drenched in sweat. His curious workmate stiffened, then concentrated furiously on the task at hand. Kater felt cold and sick. If the Tleilaxu had come for him, if they knew who he was, they would torture him for days before executing him. He tensed his muscles, ready to fight. Perhaps he could throw several of them down into the one-way magma pit before he himself was killed. Instead, the guard stepped up to the fidgety man beside Kater. Leading them, a Tleilaxu master rubbed his spidery fingers together and smiled. He had a long nose and a narrow chin. His grayish skin looked as if it had been leached of all life. "You, citizen, Suboid, or whatever you are, we have discovered your true identity." The man looked up quickly, glanced over at Kater as if beseeching him for help, but Kater studiously averted his gaze. "There's no longer any need to hide," the master continued in a syrupy voice. "We've found records. We know that you were actually an accountant, one of those who kept inventories of Ixian manufactured items." The guard clapped a hand on the man's shoulders. The worker squirmed, panicked. All pretense slid away. The Tleilaxu master stepped closer, more paternal than threatening. "You misjudge us, citizen. We have expended a great deal of effort to track you down because we have need of your services. We, Bene Tleilax, your new masters, require intelligent workers to assist us in our government headquarters. We could use someone with your mathematical expertise." The master gestured around the hot, stinking chamber. The clatter of the automated conveyor rolled on, dumping rocks and twisted scraps of metal over the lip into the blazing pit. "This work is far beneath your skills. Come with us, and we will give you something much more interesting and worthwhile to do." With a thin smile of hope, the man nodded faintly.
I'm very good at accounting. I could help you. I could be very valuable. You have to run this like a business, you know.
Kater wanted to scream a warning. How could the man be so stupid? If he'd survived for a dozen years under Tleilaxu oppression, how could he not be aware of such an obvious trick?
There, there, the master said. We'll have a council meeting, and you can tell us all your ideas.
The guard looked sharply at Kater, and the Ixion's heart froze again.
Is our business of concern to you, citizen?
Kater made every effort to keep his face slack, not to show fear in his eyes, to keep his voice slow and dull.
Now there'll be more work for me.
He looked forlornly at the assembly line.
Then work harder.
The guard and the Tleilaxu master took their captive away. Kater went back to his labors, staring at the debris, picking over every item before it toppled into the long shaft. 2 days later, Kater and his work shift were ordered to gather out on the floor of the main grotto, so they could watch the execution of the accountant spy. When he accidentally stumbled upon Miral Alekum during his monotonous daily routine, Kater covered his surprise well. He had changed jobs again, nervous by the arrest of the hidden accountant. He never used the same identity card more than 2 days in a row. He moved from assignment to assignment, enduring a few curious looks. But Ixion workers knew better than to question. Any stranger could well be a face dancer who had infiltrated work gangs in an attempt to pick up talk of unrest or secret sabotage plans. Kater had to bide his time and make new plans. He frequented different food stations, standing in long lines where bland cooked fare was distributed to the workers. The Tleilaxu had put their biological technology to work, creating unrecognizable food in hidden vats. They grew vegetables and roots by splitting cells so that the plants produced only shapeless tumors of edible material. Eating became a process rather than a pleasurable activity, as much a chore as the routine tasks during a shift. Kater remembered times he had spent in the Grand Palais with his father, the ambassador to Kaitain, and his mother, an important guild bank representative. They had sampled outworld delicacies, the finest appetizers and salads, the best imported wines. Such memories seemed like fantasies now. He could not recall what any of that food had tasted like. He straggled at the end of the line so that he did not have to fight the press of other workers. When he received his helping from the server, he noticed the large dark eyes, raggedly cropped hair, and narrow but attractive face of Miral Alekum. Their gazes locked, and recognition flashed between them. But both knew enough not to speak. Kater glanced behind him toward the seating areas, and Miral raised her spoon.
Sit at that table, worker. It's just come free.
Without questioning, Kater sat at the indicated place and began eating. He concentrated on his meal, chewing slowly to give her all the time she needed. Before long, the line ended, and the food shift was over. Finally, Miral came over, bearing her own food tray. She sat down, stared at her bowl, and began eating. Although Kater did not look directly at her, they soon began a mumbled conversation, moving their lips as little as possible.
"I work at this food distribution line," Miral said. "I've been afraid to change assignments because it might draw attention to me."
"I have lots of identity cards," Kater said.
He had never given her his correct name, and he was going to leave it that way.
"We are the only two left," Miral said. "Of the whole group." "There will be others. I've still got a few contacts. For now, I'm working alone."
"Can't accomplish much that way."
can't accomplish anything at all if I'm dead. When she slurped her food and didn't answer, he continued. I've been fighting alone for 12 years. And you haven't accomplished enough. It will never be enough until the Tleilaxu are gone and Ix has been returned to our people. He clamped his lips together, afraid he had spoken too vehemently. He took 2 slow mouthfuls from his bowl. You never told me what you were working on, those technological items you were scavenging. Do you have a plan? After glancing at him, Miral quickly tore her glance away. I'm building a detection device. I need to find out what the Tleilaxu are doing in that research pavilion they keep so carefully guarded. It's scan-shielded, Kater mumbled. I've already tried. That is why I need a new device. I think that facility is the reason behind their entire takeover. Kater was startled. What do you mean? Have you noticed that the Tleilaxu experiments have entered a new phase? Something very dark and unpleasant is happening. Kater paused with the spoon halfway to his mouth, looked over at her, and glanced down at his nearly empty bowl. He would need to eat more slowly if he wished to finish this conversation without anyone noticing. Our women have been disappearing, Miral said with a slash of anger in the back of her voice. Young women, fertile and healthy. I've watched them vanish from the work rolls. Kater had not remained in one place long enough to notice details like that. He swallowed hard. Are they abducted for Tleilaxu harems? But why would they take unclean Ixian women? Supposedly, no outsider had ever seen a Tleilaxu female. He'd heard that the Bene Tleilax guarded their women zealously, protecting them from the contamination and perversions of the Imperium. Maybe Tleilaxu women were kept hidden because they were as no-muggly as the men. Could it just be a coincidence that the missing females were all healthy and of childbearing age? Such women would make the best concubines. But the mean-spirited Tleilaxu did not seem the type who would indulge in extravagant sexual pleasures. I think the answer has something to do with what's going on in that shielded pavilion, Miral suggested. Kater set his spoon down. He only had one bite left in his bowl. I know this much. The invaders came here with a terrible purpose, not just to take over our facilities or conquer this world. They have another agenda. If they simply wanted to take over Ix for their own profit, they would not have dismantled so many factories. They would never have ceased production of the new design highliners, reactive fighting mechs, and other products that brought a fortune to House Vernius. With a nod, she said, I agree. They intend to accomplish something else, and they're doing it behind shields and closed doors. Perhaps I'll learn what it is. Miral finished her meal and stood up. If I do, I'll let you know. After she left, Kater felt a glimmer of hope again for the first time in many months. At least he wasn't the only one fighting the Tleilaxu. If one other person was involved in the effort, others must be forming pockets of resistance as well, here and there. But he hadn't heard of anything happening, not for months. His hopes sagged. He couldn't stand the thought of waiting for the right opportunity, day after day, week after week. Perhaps he'd been thinking too small. Yes, he needed to change tactics and contact someone outside for assistance. He would have to reach off-world, no matter what the risk might be. He needed to search for powerful allies to help him overthrow the Tleilaxu. And he knew of one person who had far more at stake than he did. The unknown surrounds us at any given moment. That is where we seek knowledge. Mother Superior Rakela Berto Anirul, Oratory Against Fear.
In the ornate mummer's portico of the Imperial Palace, Lady Anirul Corino stood with a delegation from Shaddam's court. Each person was dressed in extravagant finery, some ridiculously gaudy, as they awaited the arrival of yet another dignitary. It was a daily routine, but this guest was different. Count Hasimir Fenring had always been dangerous. She squinted into Kaitain's ever-flawless morning sunlight, watched trained hummingbirds flit over flowers. From orbit, the vigilant weather control satellites manipulated the flow of warm and cool air masses to maintain an optimal climate around the palace. Against her cheeks, Anirul felt the delicate kiss of a warm breeze, just the right accent on a perfect day. Perfect, except for the arrival of Count Fenring. Though he had married a Bene Gesserit equally as shrewd as himself, Fenring still made Anirul's skin crawl. A disturbing aura of shed blood surrounded him. As the Kwisatz mother, Anirul knew every detail of the Bene Gesserit breeding scheme, knew that this man had himself been bred as a potential Kwisatz Haderach in one of the offshoots of the program. But he'd been found lacking and was instead a biological dead end. But Fenring possessed an extraordinarily sharp mind and dangerous ambitions. Though he spent most of his time in Arakeen as the Imperial Spice Minister, he kept his boyhood friend Shaddam under his thumb. Anirul resented this influence, which even she, as the Emperor's wife, did not have. With a pompous clatter, an open coach drawn by two golden Harmanthep lions approached the palace gates. Guards waved the count in, and the carriage rounded the circular drive in a commotion of wheels and enormous alloy-shoed paws. Footmen stepped forward to open the carriage's enameled door. Anirul waited with her retinue, smiling like a statue. Fenring stepped down to the slate of the portico. He had decked himself out for the reception in a black frock coat and top hat, a crimson and gold sash, and gaudy badges of office. Because the Emperor admired regal trappings, it amused the Count to play along. He removed his hat and bowed, then looked up at her with large, glittering eyes. "My Lady Anirul, so nice to see you, "Count Fenring," she said with a simple bow and a pleasant smile. "Welcome back to Kaitain." Without a further word or modicum of civility, he put his top hat back on his misshapen head and walked past her on his way to an immediate audience with the Emperor. She followed him at a distance, flanked by the other peacock members of the court. Fenring's access to Shaddam was direct, and it seemed obvious to Anirul that he cared little for the fact that she disliked him. Nor did he question why she had formed such an opinion. He had no knowledge of his failed place in the breeding scheme, or the potential he had missed. Working with Sister Margit Rashinozea, whom he'd later married, Fenring had assisted in arranging Shaddam's marriage to a Bene Gesserit of hidden rank, Lady Anirul herself. At the time, the new emperor had needed to secure a subtle but powerful alliance in the uneasy transition after the death of old Elrud. Foolishly, Shaddam failed to see his precarious position, even now. The flare-up with Grumman was only one manifestation of unrest throughout the realm, as were the constant gestures of defiance, vandalism, and defacings of Corino monuments. The people no longer feared or even respected him. It disturbed Anirul that the emperor thought he no longer required Bene Gesserit influence, and rarely consulted his ancient truth-sayer, the Reverend Mother Lobia. He had also grown more annoyed with Anirul for producing no sons, pursuant to her secret orders from the sisterhood. Empires rise and fall, Anirul thought, but the Bene Gesserit remain. As she followed Fenring, she watched his athletic steps as he made his way toward her husband's throne room. Neither Shaddam nor Fenring understood all the subtleties and behind-the-scenes activities that glued the Imperium together. The Bene Gesserit excelled in the arena of history, where the glitter and pomp of ceremony had no importance. Compared with Kwisatz's mother Anirul, both the Padishah Emperor and Hasimir Fenring were rank amateurs, and didn't even know it. Inwardly she smiled, sharing her amusement with the crowded sisters in other memory, her constant companions from thousands of past lives. The millennia-long breeding program would culminate soon in the birth of a male Bene Gesserit of extraordinary powers. It would happen in 2 generations, if all plans came to fruition. Here, while masquerading as a devoted wife to the Emperor, Anirul pulled all the strings, controlled every effort. She commanded Mohiam back on Wallach 9, who worked with her secret daughter by Baron Harkonnen. She watched the other sisters as they laid plans within plans to connect Jessica with House Atreides. Ahead of her, Fenring moved confidently, knowing his way around the city-sized imperial palace better than any man, better even than Emperor Shaddam himself. He crossed a magnificent jewel-tiled entry and stepped into the imperial audience chamber. The immense room contained some of the most priceless art treasures in a million worlds, but he had seen them all before. Without a backward glance, he tossed his hat to a footman and strode across the polished stone floor toward the throne. It was a long walk. Anirul hovered next to one of the massive support columns. Courtiers flitted about in self-important business, entering private gossip stations. She skirted priceless statuaries as she made her way toward an acoustically superior alcove where she often stood within easy listening distance. On the translucent blue-green golden lion throne sat the Padishah Emperor Shaddam IV, the 81st Corino to rule the Imperium. He wore layers of military-style clothing, accented by jangling medals and badges and ribbons. Weighed down by the trappings of rank, he could barely move. His withered truthsayer, Lobia, stood in an alcove off to one side of the crystal throne. Lobia was the third leg of Shaddam's advisory tripod, which included the high-browed court chamberlain Redondo and Hasimir Fenring. Though, since the Count's well-publicized banishment, the Emperor rarely consulted him in public. Shaddam refused to notice his wife. 15 Bene Gesserit sisters stationed in the palace were like shadows flitting silently between rooms, there, but not there, as he intended them to be. Their loyalty to Shaddam was unquestioned, especially after his marriage to Anirul. Some served as ladies-in-waiting, while others cared for the royal daughters Irulan, Chalice, and Wensisha, and would tutor them one day. The ferret-like imperial observer bobbed along a river of red carpeting, and then up the wide, shallow steps of the dais to the base of the throne. Shaddam leaned forward on his perch while Fenring came to a stop, bowed deeply, and looked up with a smile twitching his lips. Even Anirul didn't know why the Count had rushed here from Arrakis. But the Emperor did not look pleased. "As my servant, Hasimir, I expect you to keep me advised about events in your purview. Your latest report is incomplete."
My apologies if your Highness feels I have omitted something of importance."
Fenring spoke quickly as his mind raced through possibilities, trying to guess the reason for Shaddam's ire.
"I do not wish to trouble you with trivialities that are best handled by myself."
His eyes flicked from side to side, calculating.
What concerns you, sire?"
"Word has reached me that the Harkonnens are suffering heavy losses of men and equipment on Arrakis through guerrilla activities. Spice production has begun to fall off again, and I have been troubled by numerous complaints from the Spacing Guild. How much of this is true?"
"My Emperor, the Harkonnens whine too much. Perhaps it is a ploy to raise the price of melange on the open market, or to justify a request for lower imperial tariffs. How has the Baron explained it?
I could not ask him, Shaddam said, springing his trap. According to reports from a highliner that just arrived, he has gone to Wallach 9 with a fully armed frigate. What is that all about?
Alarmed, Fenring raised his eyebrows, then rubbed his long nose. The Bene Gesserit Mother School? To be honest, I was not aware of that. The Baron doesn't seem the sort who would consult with the Sisterhood.
Equally astonished, Anirul leaned forward at her listening post. Why would Baron Harkonnen possibly go to Wallach 9? Certainly not to obtain advisers, for he had made no secret of his dislike for the Sisterhood after they'd forced him to provide a healthy daughter for the breeding program. Why, then, would he bring a military ship? She calmed her racing pulse. This didn't sound good. The Emperor snorted.
Not much of an observer, are you, Hasimir? Why, too, has there been a bizarre defacement of my most expensive statue in Arsunt? That's right in your backyard.
Fenring blinked his large, dark eyes.
I was not aware of any vandalism in Arsunt, sire. When did it happen?
Someone took the liberty of adding anatomically correct genitalia to the front of my imperial likeness. But because the perpetrator made the size of the organ so small, no one even saw it until recently.
Fenring had trouble stifling a laugh.
That is unfortunate, sire.
I don't find it so amusing, especially when added to other outrages and insults. This has been going on for years. Who is doing it?
Abruptly, Shaddam stood from his throne and brushed a hand down the front of his uniform, jangling the medals and badges.
Come to my private den, Hasimir. We must discuss this in greater detail.
When he raised his head in a haughty, imperial gesture, Fenring reacted too smoothly. Anirul realized that, although the affronts Shaddam mentioned had been real enough, the discussion had merely been a ploy to bring the Count here for another purpose, something they would not discuss in front of others.
Men are so clumsy when they try to keep secrets.
While she would have found those secrets interesting enough, Anirul was much more concerned and alarmed about what the Baron intended at Wallach 9. She and the truth-sayer Lobia, on opposite sides of the imperial throne, communicated by discreet hand signs. A message would be dispatched to the mother school immediately. Crafty old Harishka would have ample opportunity to plan an appropriate response. Thinking, and the methods by which thoughts are communicated, inevitably create a system permeated by illusions. Zen Sunni teaching. As the arrogant-looking witch, Christine, guided Baron Harkonnen through the maze of shadowy passageways, his walking stick clicked like gunshots on the cold flagstone floor. With his six guards behind him, he hobbled forward, trying to keep up.
"Your mother superior has no choice but to listen," the Baron said in a strident voice. "If I don't get the cure I need, the Emperor will learn of the Sisterhood's crimes."
Christine ignored him. She tossed her short, chestnut hair and never looked back. It was a damp night on Wallach 9, the outside silence broken only by cold breezes. Yellow globes illuminated the corridors of the complex of school buildings. No sisters stirred, and only shadows moved. The Baron felt as if he were walking into a tomb, which it would be if he ever brought his case before the Landsrad. Breaking the Great Convention was the most serious offense the witches could commit. He held all the cards. Haloed by pulsing light from poorly tuned glow globes, Christine marched ahead until she seemed to fade from view. The young witch glanced back, but did not wait for him. When one of the guards tried to assist the Baron, he responded by shoving the arm away and continuing on his own, as best he could manage.
A shiver ran up his spine, as if someone had whispered a curse in his ear. The Bene Gesserit had hidden fighting skills, and there must be swarms of them in this lair. What if the Mother Superior didn't care about his accusations? What if the old hag thought he was bluffing? Even his armed Harkonnen troopers could do nothing to keep the witches from killing him in their own nest, should they choose to attack. But the Baron knew they dared not act against him. Where are all the witches hiding? Then he grinned. They must be afraid of me. With an angry huff, the Baron reviewed the demands he would make. 3 simple concessions, and he would not file formal charges in the Landsrad. A cure for his disease, delivering Gaius Helen Mohiam to him intact and ready for utter humiliation, and the return of the 2 daughters he'd been coerced into fathering. The Baron was curious about how his offspring fit into the witch's plans, but he supposed he could back off on that demand, if necessary. He didn't really want a couple of female brats anyway, but it gave him negotiating room. Sister Christine moved ahead while the guards hung back to match the Baron's painful, plodding pace. She turned a corner into shadows ahead of him. The pulsing glow globes seemed too yellow, too filled with static. They began to give him a headache, and he wasn't seeing clearly. When the Baron's entourage turned the corner, they saw only an empty hall. Christine was gone. The cool stone walls echoed with the disconcerted gasps of the Harkonnen escort. A weak breeze, like cadaverous breath, oozed across the air and stole under the Baron's clothing. Involuntarily he shivered. He heard a faint whisper, like scuttling rodent feet, but saw no movement. "Run ahead and check it out." He nudged the squad leader in the side. "Where did she go?" One of the troopers unshouldered his laser rifle and ran along the glow-globe illuminated corridor. Moments later, he shouted back, "Nothing here, my Lord Baron." His voice had an eerie, hollow quality, as if this place sucked sound and light from the air. "No one in sight anywhere." The Baron waited, his senses alert. Cold sweat trickled down his back, and he narrowed his spider-black eyes, more in consternation than in terror. "Check all passageways and rooms in the vicinity, and report back to me." The Baron looked down the corridor, refusing to step deeper into the trap. "And don't be so edgy that you shoot each other." His men disappeared from view, and he no longer heard their shouts or footsteps either. This place felt like a mausoleum, and damned cold. He hobbled into an alcove and stood silently with his back to a wall, ready to protect himself. He unholstered a personal flechette pistol, checked its charge of poisoned needles, and held his breath.